The United Nations has no power to do anything about these rights in the last resort. Let's take, for example, the specific case of South Africa, about which India is very greatly concerned today. Facts about South Africa can be seen by anyone in this week's Life magazine, based on a report by Margaret Burke White. These facts are, and I quote, "In South Africa, a nation smaller in area than the 11 states of the United States South, 2.5 million whites now control the lives and destinies of 8 million African natives, blacks, 1 million coloreds, half-castes, and 250,000 Asiatics. The conditions there are conditions of near slavery, misery, and tyranny." Now, this may be deplorable, McKeon, but what is your United Nations, under this kind of instrument, going to do about this case?
I think that's a difficult question, but it's one that we must face. There is a danger, as you say, of inflaming war. But the danger is in two directions. One is the danger that would come from intruding into the affairs, as the traditional historian would look upon it, of a sovereign nation, South Africa. South Africa is at present defying the United Nations on the point of a mandate territory, West South Africa, which was once a German province. But the other equally grave danger of inflaming a war comes from consideration of what would happen if one ignores the great moral issue that is presented by South Africa. May I put it this way? It seems to me that power is not the whole answer. Power is part. The moral issue is itself a matter of power. Hanson Baldwin, in the discussion of a purely military question, made a very striking quotation from Napoleon. "There are two kinds of force," Napoleon said, "the sword and the spirit."
Yes, well, that appeals very much to me. I think that the least value of a declaration of rights is that it shall produce all inflammation short of war. And as to the relationship of your moral development to the exercise of power now, I think it is most important for us to remember that the great issues between countries may be represented as power issues, but in fact they're issues of will. As a philosopher once said, the basis of the state is will, not force. Wills are contending against each other, and wills are partly composed of their moral code.
I can't let Simpson's question go, however, without commenting on the weakness of the United Nations to which he referred. There is a weakness in the fact that the United Nations does not have lawmaking power, cannot exercise the police power in its own right until this last Korean episode. But I think that in that situation there is also a strength. Putting it briefly, the debates in the United Nations are against the background of a possible appeal to force. That means when there is disagreement, it is the moral issue which decides. We must consider the effects of what we say about South Africa on the peoples of Asia, South Asia, India, Indonesia, and on Africa itself.
Yes, McKeon. My point, of course, is still that I'm concerned about the fundamental disagreements which evidently underlie the unity, perhaps in some ways the superficial unity, of such declarations as these. If we had time, for example, we could examine the radically different approach of Eastern and Western democracy to such a crucial problem as freedom of opinion. This we can't do, but what I think we might do is to concentrate for a moment or two on the divergence which exists between two sets of aspirations in the world today. The aspirations of our Western, liberal, democratic tradition on the one hand, and the aspirations of Eastern communism on the other, and perhaps to that we might even add the new nations of Asia, which occupy some kind of middle position between Russia and ourselves. Now, just exactly how has this divergence arisen, would you say, McKeon?
That's a question which is discussed in some detail in the volume on human rights, which is the subject of the home study course that is attached to this program. They arose, I think, not as divergent aspirations, but rather as historical developments. I would be inclined to say that the traditional human rights, and let's enumerate them, the freedom of speech, the freedom of the press, freedom of religion, of assembly, of fair trial, freedom from arbitrary arrest and imprisonment, these were developed in the nations of the West over a long period. In the new nations, the problems of an economic, social, and cultural sort came at the same moment as these political problems. There have been in our times the beginnings of three great revolutions. In the second decade of the century, in Russia, the revolution of Lenin. In China, the revolution of Sun Yat-sen. In India, the revolution of Gandhi. They were different revolutions, but they were all based on the fact that in these large nations, hundreds of millions of people no longer saw the necessity of living under the constant and periodical threat of famine, disease, insecurity.
This has brought about not only a difference in the scope of rights, whether you include the economic and with the political, but I think it has brought about a very, very serious difference in the nature of rights. The Western rights, which are the accretion of the hundreds of years of development, mean that they are rights for the individual, A, against the whole community, and B, against the government. But I can't help thinking that I discern in the Eastern, whether it's Russian or further Eastern form of rights, this, that the rights are benefits granted by the community which owns them and grants them through the government, but is in fact, that government is in fact a dictatorial monopolist of the right to do it or not, regardless of the will of the people, you see.
Well, let me ask this question of both of you. What do you consider should be Americans' attitude towards the economic and social aspirations of these other countries, which we, on our part, have been able to satisfy within the framework of political democracy, but which they quite evidently haven't?
I think that the attitude should be based upon the recognition that in this distinction that we are now dealing with, an extremely difficult distinction, you have the possible peaceful resolution of what might otherwise be a violent resolution of the problem of the Cold War. It seems to me a basic error to suppose that the political rights must be sacrificed in order to bring social, economic, and cultural rights to a level. On the other hand, it seems to me a basic error of the West to suppose that because we have spent 150 years in setting up security against arbitrary arrest, search, and seizure, that we can sit back and let the rest of the world catch up with us.
Yes, well, I quite agree with you. I think that any rights that we think are good enough for ourselves are, we should regard as good for other people and help them to attain them. But it does arouse some very, very important practical questions. They have claims on us. I would acknowledge those claims, and we ought to do all in our power, our economic, political, technical power, to help them forward to their welfare according to their own aspirations. But supposing that aren't we really obliged by our own political point of view, by our own spiritual inheritance, to ask that in the use of the means that we might make available to them, they should not forget the political and civic rights.
I think that is extremely important, but let's make it specific. In the case of the Indonesian people who've come recently into the possibility of self-government, one of their first acts was to ask for admission to UNESCO, partly to cure the evil of illiteracy, which exceeds 80% in Indonesia. Without that educational solution, self-government is impossible. Without self-government, the civil rights are impossible. But in addition, you need technical aid in order to put into some condition the economic resources of the country.
Yeah, but if the United Nations and the United States proffered help, and help on decent conditions of democracy and liberty, if that were rejected by those governments, of course, they would go their own way, but we would still be up against the question, what would we do, what would we have to do, if those governments, carrying out their revolution in their own way, disturbed the peace of the world?
I think all we can do now is to record our opinion of these proposals. My own is that an enterprise like this may have one of two fates, both disastrous. It may end in nothing more than pious aspirations, recorded and forgotten, or if not forgotten, surviving as one of those lies which serve a formal purpose without deceiving the mind. Alternatively, it may be made an instrument for unlicensed intervention in the internal affairs of other states, producing nothing but recrimination and disunion. Between these possibilities lies a small hope that some constructive good may come out of it. If we can convince ourselves that we are reasonably free from what Emerson called the nonsense of our own wigwam, if we can widen our understanding of human rights to include the aspirations of European socialists, of the new nations of Asia, and of the peoples still submerged under foreign or feudal rule, then we may have whatever advantages belong to nations whose leadership rests on moral authority and political intelligence, as well as on steel production and atomic bombs.
Well, I take a very long-run point of view. I think an international bill of human rights has two purposes. One is to endow men and women with rights out of sheer humanity itself and directly. I regard this as a purpose of a decent human life, as I regard mercy and charity as a fundamental of existence. The other purpose of the Bill of Rights is to support those rights within nations which will loosen the hold of a dictatorial government on the mind, the will, and spirit of its people, and especially to give them the right to listen to what other nations are saying. I think this makes for less caprice on the part of government and the common man's hold over the issues of war and peace.
The central problem of our times, I think, can be reduced to the question of human rights. In the framework of the United Nations, these two sets of problems that you enumerate, Finer, the moral problem and the practical problem, are combined. They're combined into a problem of understanding and cooperation, in which a mere declaration or a covenant that will provide against infringement on rights is not enough. The positive program that is contained in the activities of the specialized agencies of the United Nations, in UNESCO, in the World Health Organization, in the Farm and Food and Agriculture Organization, these are means by which the people of the world may aspire to the realization of fundamental human rights in the dignity, the worth of the human person, and finally to the promotion of social progress and better standards of life in a larger freedom rendered possible by these procedures.
Thank you, gentlemen. Taking part in today's University of Chicago roundtable on how can we enforce human rights throughout the world were Richard McKeon, philosopher, Herman Finer, political scientist, and Alan Simpson, historian, all of the University of Chicago. Richard McKeon, Distinguished Service Professor of Philosophy at the University of Chicago, who served as rapporteur of the UNESCO Committee on the Philosophical Bases of Human Rights, has prepared a lesson guide for your study of the problems of human rights. This radio home study course is reprinted in full in last week's roundtable pamphlet. You will want to order copies of this pamphlet and read the outline lesson guide and decide whether you wish to enroll for the roundtable home study course on human rights. Each month, a 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica is awarded to the registered student most successfully completing the course on human rights. In this course, you can learn about the origins of major ideas on human rights, conflicting ideas on the application of universal rights, and what human rights mean in this country and the world. Be sure to write to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, for further information about the course and for your copy of the pamphlet. Today's pamphlet reprints the first draft International Covenant of Human Rights. Individual copies are 10 cents in coin. Send 20 cents with your order and receive last week's pamphlet on human rights also. Address the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. A four-year subscription to the Roundtable pamphlet costs only $3. Enclose $3 with your order and make your subscription begin with last week's program on human rights. I'll repeat the address, the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Next week, the Roundtable continues its series on problems of Asia with a report on Japan. Today's program originated from the Mitchell Tower Studios of the University of Chicago. The Roundtable is directed by George E. Probst. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.